Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Phoenix, Arizona, it's time for Valley Business Radio, spotlighting the Valley's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Hello and welcome to Valley Business Radio, where we tell the stories that traditional media tends to ignore and help connect you to the right people. I'm your host, Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and I'm joined in the studio today for another conversation brought to you by the Global Chamber. We have three young, global, internationally minded, locally active leaders here in the studio, and I look forward to getting to know each of you and learning more about your background, about your current work, and about your vision for the future of global local relationships here in Arizona. To my left is Ali Anderson, a corporate attorney in the Phoenix office of Squire Patton Boggs. I'm also joined by Anibal Abena, who is an Ethiopian Canadian citizen, an entrepreneur. He's got many interesting things happening we're going to learn about, and Tina Swayze, social impact consultant and education leader. We'll learn more about each of you, but I want to start by just saying welcome. Thank you all for joining me.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Ali, why don't we start with you? Just give us a brief introduction to your work, kind of how you got into this role, and we'll use that as a springboard to begin exploring these issues with each of our guests.
Sure. So as you mentioned, I am a corporate attorney at Squire Patton Boggs. It is a leading international law firm with an office here in Phoenix. What's pretty unique about us, especially in Phoenix, is that we have a global platform. So we have more than 1,400 attorneys based in 19 countries on five different continents. And so our practice is truly global. We also have a strong public policy branch, which means we're able to guide our clients through policy, legislative, government relation type issues. And so what I do, I am a corporate attorney, but I focus mostly on mergers and acquisitions, business transactions, financial services matters, things of that nature. But I've been with the firm in Phoenix about 3 years. And since that time, most of our deals have been international in nature. And so we have clients based out of Japan and Singapore, India, and the UK. And there's always some sort of Phoenix or Arizona nexus, which is really awesome because I started my career in DC. And I never thought that I could have this type of career based in Phoenix. I'm from here. I love Arizona. And now that I'm back, I truly believe you can have a global practice here and do everything you could do on the East Coast, but you get to enjoy the lifestyle in the Arizona community. And so I'm thankful to be back. And I think there's a lot of great opportunity.
Fabulous. And I look forward to exploring a lot of those issues with you. Anibal Abena, you had a very different upbringing. You did not grow up in urban Arizona, but in Ethiopia. Can you introduce us a little bit to your background and to your current work?
Yeah, I was born in Ethiopia, Addis Ababa, the capital city. And I was a videographer for more than 14 years and back home. And 2006, I moved to Canada, and I've been in Canada for at least 8 years, I believe. And I moved here to join my family. My family own a restaurant here in Tempe. It's an Ethiopian restaurant, Cafe Lalibela. Cafe Lalibela been here almost 23 years in Arizona. We are the first African restaurant in Arizona. And we become now actually the first African food mainstream providers like Whole Foods and Natural Groceries, all the way to Western United States. I can call it like South Pacific, California, Nevada, Hawaii, and here. And I also reform a nonprofit organization called African Fest USA. It's a cultural exchange festival. I'm a founder and executive director of the African Fest USA, and we had an amazing partnership with City of Tempe. And we host the first of its kind as Arizona Republic hosted in Arizona history here in Tempe in March 30th. And we had an amazing turnout for more than 3,000 people show up for our first festival. And we're looking forward for the next year again.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to hearing about that. It's coming up in March.
March 28, 2020, yeah.
You know, I want to circle back, Anibal, to you to talk about Ethiopian food. I moved here from Oakland, California, and we have a very vibrant population, a lot of restaurants up and down Telegraph Avenue where I used to live. And it's amazing to me how, in so many instances, one dimension of global entrepreneurship that often involves families is the restaurant business, and how so much of the time that's kind of tip of the spear in entering new markets and beginning to create awareness, and then it grows and expands from there. The restaurants remain the hub in so many ways for families, for companies, for nonprofits from that community. So I want to talk about some of those details. I'm really glad you're here. Tina Swayze, why don't you give us a background about your kind of personal history and your current work?
All right. My name is Tina Swayze. I moved to Arizona 6 years ago from Jordan. While I was in Jordan, I worked in change management for education, and I was also working as an advisor at the Prime Minister's Office for Youth Policy. So I want to talk about the connection with that passion for developing the young global leaders through the Global Chamber, first of all. I've been in Arizona for 6 years. I've moved here with my son, looking for better healthcare options. And I was glad to find it here in Arizona. However, at the same time, I found Arizona to also be a place where there is a lot of the brain gain, being a big retirement village. And it was inspiring for me because there's a lot of really expert know-hows who have retired and they have a lot to give back. And this is what led me to joining Global Chamber, being on the advisory board and really proposing with Doug having a Young Global Leaders initiative in Arizona.
You know, certainly your background in education, your work in the educational sector in Jordan, but then also some of the other projects I happen to know you've been involved with that I hope you'll talk a little bit about.
Yes, sure.
The theater.
New Thing Theater, yes.
Right? So it's such an important initiative to begin to connect the dots for young people. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested, as we kind of work our way back and forth around this room to begin developing this conversation. Ali, when did you first, you know, growing up here in Arizona is not exactly a global childhood, right? So when did you first begin to realize that not only was there a world out there, but that you might play a role in it?
You know, it's funny. So I am a proud product of the Scottsdale public school system. And I think when I was in middle school, and you know, you get the chance to choose your language and you can choose Spanish, which would seem like the natural and obvious choice here, or French. I chose to take French because I thought it was a global language. And it really sort of opened the door for me to sort of get out because I couldn't speak Spanish. And so I thought I'd have to go elsewhere to sort of use my skills. But you know, when I was in college, because I stayed in state, I went through Barrett, the Honors College, the business school, and I studied economics. And working for the Greater Phoenix Economic Council in undergrad, working on global economic issues and policy, it started to open my eyes to what we could do, not just as economists, but as an Arizonan going out in the world and doing more. And so when I was in college, I worked for Senator Kyle in D.C., started to work on anti-terror policy, terror finance, a little bit of Russian military work. And that led to me working in the Netherlands at the U.S. Embassy in The Hague in their economic section. And so it kind of snowballed. I don't know if it was necessarily, you know, a strategic choice at the beginning, but sort of once I got the ball rolling and was exposed to all these different opportunities, I mean, it was just phenomenal. And I know for sure if I'd gone anywhere else for school, I wouldn't have ended up where I am and having the same broad sort of international experience. But it, you know, I think Arizona is a unique platform because it's very comfortable. It's very easy to do well here and do good. And it's a very like close-knit community. But places like ASU, known for innovation, known for their programming, I mean, you can do anything you want. You just have to apply yourself. And so I really feel fortunate to have left and come back and to see other people who have left and come back because they're now investing in our community and they're bringing sort of the globe back to Phoenix. And I think we're finally starting to take advantage of our massive economy here.
That is certainly a trend that I know the Global Chamber is passionately committed to. It's something I'm personally very interested in. Tina, for you, growing up in Jordan, I don't think people realize, and certainly Ethiopia, we're going to talk about, has deep roots in international connections or African continental connections and beyond. But Tina, you're from a small town in Jordan, and yet Jordan itself is very much an international scene, always has been since the invention of the country, more or less after World War I. So what was it like for you beginning to find your way, right? You're from Fahais, a town I've visited back when, I don't know if Zoada is still open, the restaurant and the historic place, but used to go there a lot. Christian town, mm-hmm. And outside of Amman. its own kind of deep history going back to the Ottomans and earlier. But then Amman itself over the years has evolved really into a regional hub. So for you personally, how did you begin to find your way into that global world?
Well, to start with, my family immigrated to Chicago before I was born, and they are from that city, Fahes, which is one of the biggest Christian cities in Jordan.
Along with Asalt and Madaba, basically yes. the mm-hmm. three kind of mm-hmm. large Christian.
Well, they're under one directorate, Al-Balqa, so... I grew up between the two cultures, the American culture and the Jordanian culture, but there was always that rootedness in the Jordanian culture that I found is home, and I always wanted to come back and be the change there. Amman has it's blessed to be a hub not only for an international location in the Middle East. It's it has all of the embassies of the world actually in one country, and it's aside from what mainstream media says, it's one of the safest countries there, and it's very progressive. It's known for its youth with a lot of talent. And this is what we say, you know, human talent is one of our biggest resources in Jordan. So this is what caught my interest since the beginning, is to actually, how do you equip and how do you inspire young people to stay in their country and be the change while being global? I mean, we're at a time where location is no longer an issue. And...
Right. And some people's ability to be global mm-hmm. varies depending on their situation, their citizenship, whether they have papers or not. I mean, the history of successive Palestinian migrations into Jordan, some willingly, some unwillingly, makes it a very interesting place from that perspective, Palestinian and Jordanian, mm-hmm. Which in many ways overlap and yet are not the same. Amman has also benefited, I think, from deep international connections. Partly because it's a rentier state, partly because it's dependent on foreign aid mm-hmm. in many ways. It's not an oil-producing country. Tourism is a major source of the economy, mm-hmm. et cetera. Let's talk about Addis Ababa for a minute, because, Anibal, for you, this is about as cosmopolitan of an African city as you can get, right? Were you born in town or outside?
Yeah, I was born in Addis Ababa, the capital city of Africa, actually. It's not only Ethiopian, because the headquarters of African Union is in Addis Ababa.
Right.
And the whole European Union and most of, I think, majority of the country's embassy also in Addis Ababa at this time. I believe more than 100-something countries, they have an embassy there.
Second most populous country in all of Africa. Mm-hmm. The single most populous landlocked country in the entire world.
Yes.
And very dynamic.
We become recently landlocked, like 30 years ago, I guess.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, there's certainly that pesky conflict mm-hmm. with your northern neighbor. Yeah. But Ethiopia's history itself, in a way, you know, from the early empire through the Italian period, through Haile Selassie, through the communist, Marxist, yeah. Leninist military junta that was in place there for a while, you had to learn to navigate a lot of different layers of identity, relations, things of that nature. Take us back to these earlier years when you're a young man, you're doing videography. What's it like in that environment? How did you find that kind of work?
Yeah, as you said, in Ethiopia is the only country never been colonized in Africa. And we keep our tradition. So that's why, you know, if you go to other African countries, you can't see any, you know, raw culture. The only culture you can get is in Africa, because most of them are mixed with European colonies, countries, you know, or language or something. But for example, if you go to Ethiopia, we have our own calendar, our own number, our own alphabet. We have more than 80 tribes with different dialogues. It's a really beautiful culture thing. So when we start videographing, when I was in high school, actually, and start working with a small production, like, you know, weddings and this, but we don't have enough school, like a film school, like an institute, a huge institute, universities there. So we have to teach ourselves from, you know, small thing, Googling and everything. And that's how I learned. And Then we become, I used to do like music videos, you know, documentary movies, those kind of production. And I used to own my own production there. It's an amazing lifestyle, I can call it, because we don't know that big, we don't have enough resource to get kind of, like big movies, what we see here in Hollywood. So to
or like Morocco, always
anywhere,
gets the
yeah.
desert scenes.
It's so tough for us, but we did everything what we can, whatever we have there. So it was amazing experience for me, but that's the reason why I moved to Canada, to better education for film directing, which I didn't go through. You know, the life changed when you come here. Everything is different. I start a little bit, but you know, my life changed to other field. Yeah. But in Addis Ababa, it was a good production. We started it now, but now this time it's growing. It's much better.
Now, there's a couple of layers to all of that. Addis Ababa is certainly a deeply international city.
It is.
Not only because the Organization of African Unity, but then its predecessor, the African Union, mm-hmm. is essentially the regional body for all the African nations, but also because every large NGO on the planet has an office there, either for advocacy and lobbying or service delivery, things of that nature. The interesting thing, Tina mentioned a minute ago how the stereotypes of the Middle East circulate around, you know, terrorism and things like that. Certainly, Africa has its own burden of stereotypes in the outside world. That, you know, the country has been, the story of Africa is either the story of conflict or famine or AIDS or diamonds or oil or what have you. And that's, there's some, or corruption. The last of the big, whatever, big seven or whatever I just said. And of course, there are those things. And yet there's an incredibly dynamic, vibrant set of economies, local and regional economies. 11 of the fastest growing economies on Earth are on the African continent. And in some of these very cosmopolitan cities, you have a way of life and a mindset that is not matching the typical thing. When you come from there first to Canada, and then from Canada to the US, and those are two very distinct types of experience I'd like to hear more about. How do you find, what's it like for you as you go through that process? First, your immigration and citizenship process in Canada, but then coming from Canada to the US. Can you speak a little bit about what that was like, some of the differences, some of the similarities?
For me, it was not that hard because, again, Addis Ababa is a metropolitan. We've been, communicating with the world. That's what I can call it. And then I used to work with big NGOs like UNICEF, WHO, those kind of organizations that give us, we make some documentaries for those organizations. So I
should add, by the way, part of my knowledge of this comes, I used to work for Oxfam. So
those are also exactly. There. There is a lot of NGOs there. So when I moved to Canada, the first thing is a little bit different for me is the cold, the snow, because I was in Western Canada, in Calgary, Alberta. The first city was Edmonton, actually, and it's so cold. I came in January. That's a transition is a little bit difficult.
I've been to Edmonton in January. My wife is actually born outside of Edmonton, although she tells everybody she's from Victoria because they moved there when she was a teenager.
But that's only, and then more white people you see there. You know, we have a few in Addis, and then when you come there, that's a difference. There is nothing. But other than that, we adapt more to most of the, as a metropolitan city in Addis Ababa. So that was a little bit the different thing. And then, I came in 2006, so which is, I was very, adult, so no problem for me to adapt. And transition to here, to U.S., I become Canadian citizen there, after 4 years. And then Canada is the best country on earth for me. I really love Canada. Canada is a country that gives you more opportunity. That's why I believe in for
it is certainly unique in North America for having mm-hmm. a very multicultural policy baked into the national mm-hmm. charter and to the
and it's really care for the people. The system is good for the people, really cares in so many ways, in health care, you name it, in education. For example, here we have schools based on zip codes. in Canada, there is not such a thing like that. You can learn everybody. If you are rich or poor, everything is the same. Healthcare, everybody had equal opportunity. And one thing I like about Canada is the immigration system. The immigration system for Canada, for example, you know, if you are illegal immigrant, you come to Canada, the first thing they give you is a social insurance number, what we call it, a social security number. It starts with number 9. That social insurance number, it can help you to work, to buy a house, to do business, education, anything you want until your case is closed. So that means you are a taxpayer now. You're not burdened for the government. Plus, you have all access, and then you're going to be a good citizen. You don't have any, you're not going to involve in any, you know, bad activities. So that way they keep you, you know, safe and they give you opportunity. Nobody's going to have a problem. So when I think about, you know, American immigration system and then the Canadian immigration system, for me, I'm like, they're not very far. Why they're not copy-pasted here instead of they have like 11 million illegal immigrants? So think about those 11 million people who pay tax here. So it's going to be boosting the economy here for sure. So I don't know how we can't make it here, but...
We've talked about this in this studio. Mm-hmm. Just a couple of weeks ago, we had a show about the DACA program, mm-hmm. the deferred action for childhood arrivals. So people who came here because they were brought here as children, some of them before they even remember, and who've grown up here. And the DACA program created not a pathway to citizenship, but a temporary...
Until your case closed.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Registration that created work permits and so on. It's currently under review of the Supreme Court because the Trump administration said in 2017 they were canceling it, et cetera, et cetera. These are things that I think all global democracies must somehow find a way to deal with in a new and thoughtful way. And at the same time is driven too... And now I'm showing a little bit of my own position here, but... At the same time, is driven so much by a vocal minority that is afraid of losing its supremacy.
That's a smart move, and it's beneficial for the country too.
Well, from an economic perspective, there's no question.
For the community, you know, for criminality here and any illegal activities, it will solve all problems. No. And, you know, it's going to be much, you know, less... burden for the government too here, for American government, you know, if they at least copy-paste Canadian system.
You have a very entrepreneurial bent, it seems. Even, you know, to work in video production requires a lot of hustle, not just on the technical production side, which is challenging every day, but to generate the business, to build the relationships, to maintain the client contracts, et cetera, et cetera. You tried that again in Canada. Then you've switched into other things. I'm curious to know, when you came here, 2013, was it?
When I moved,
When you moved to Arizona.
Yeah.
I'm wondering what the story is here, because I read your bio and it says you came to work for Cafe La Labella.
Yeah, that's my family business.
And yet very soon, seems like you were taking that business into some new directions. Can you speak about that?
Yeah, because when I come to here, you know, I saw my mom, she's working like 14 hours, 16 hours in the restaurant kitchen. You know how hard is the restaurant kitchen is. And she suffered a lot, because this is why I really respect women in my, you know, every life, because they are the one who take us in so many levels. You know, that she sacrificed her life 25 years here, working in the kitchen. When I come in here, see her, I'm like, I got to do something better for her, because she needs some break. She did that for the last 20-something years. So I'm like, I got to do something. So we research, you know, me and my wife, we research, you know, how we can make it better, you know, how make it, you know, the next step, what it's going to be. When I go and research all the resource here, I learned that in America, the mainstream market, most people buy food from there, prepackaged food. I'm like, oh, so we can do this. Yeah, so let's try this. And then I just did my homework and the packaging, the nutrition factor, and everything. We did that. And then in Tempe, there was a Whole Food, and the older one before they changed out the new. And we went to Whole Food. I don't know nobody. Me and my wife, we went there. We package our one of the stew we sell. It's called red lentil. We take that, and then we ask for manager in Tempe store. We don't know nothing about it, by the way. It's just a no. So the manager came and she's like, what can I help you? And I said, you know, we own a restaurant for this much year and we're trying to sell our food here in your store. Can you please help us? What is the process? And then I gave it to her. She's like, she was jumping. I'm like, what's wrong with you? And she's like, you don't know me, but I'm your 13 years customer. And she loved that red lentil food, the one I gave it to her. She's like, I'm not going to give you this back. And I'm going to eat it. I'm like, oh, okay, you can have it. And she said, oh, when are you going to start? I'm like, what do you mean when are you going to start? I'm like, because our restaurant that time, the kitchen is like 450 square foot. We don't have enough space. We have only one table, like 1 6-foot or 8-foot table. So we need to be prepared. But the thing is, I want to work something better. That's why I just did my homework anyways. And she's like, you're ready to go. I'm like, okay. And then I go home and then we just start thinking about it and how we can make it the production. And after a couple of weeks, I contact her and then I'm like, when can I start? I'm like, are you not ready yet? I'm like, oh, she was already, you know, making the paperwork and everything we'd done. And I asked her how many stores you guys can give us for the to start. She's like, I'm managing Arizona and Nevada, so I can give you 2 states. I'm like, oh, that's too much for us because we don't know the business model, so we have to learn slowly. Then we start only here in the valley. I asked for that. She said, okay, go ahead and start in the valley here. And then we start from the in the valley. So now it's growing. Thank God.
As far as what are, you know, from a very skewed Western point of view called ethnic cuisines, mm-hmm. Ethiopian is one that has always struck me that more people aren't in love with because it's something for everybody. Incredible meat dishes, vegetarians and vegans can do very well.
Yeah.
It's a lot of whole grains, a lot of, you know, very wonderful things. And as I say, I moved here from Oakland where like, you know, every 6 feet is another Ethiopian Eritrean restaurant. So as you are growing this business and trying to reach into new markets, what are you finding along the way? What are some of the challenges? What are some of the opportunities?
Yeah, the challenges are giving awareness for the community, the population here. It's a little bit tough because some people, they don't know nothing about even Ethiopia exists. So I have to go and then out to every store, teach people, you know, educate people how, what is the food about? Is it gluten-free, sugar-free, nut-free, preservative-free, everything free? You know, it's like very healthy food, all natural. So I have to make them taste. And that's a very big challenge. And even the buyers also have, you know, they are a hard time to understand the food first. That's still today, that's our challenge. But there are so many open-minded people, they love their food. We still have people come to our restaurant for 20-something years. They come and eat there until today. So that's the big challenge is, you know, telling people. That's why now, for example, we joined the Global Chamber of Commerce because of Doug. And then I know I'm hoping now there are opportunities more how to networking and teach people based on, you know, how we can sell more out of the country and other states too.
Yeah, my outlook on that is very positive because, again, once people taste the product, I mean, I don't know. It seems like
it will tell itself.
It will.
And the festival is a very good idea as well. It's a creative idea to start with.
Absolutely. We'll come back to that. Ali Anderson, you have a unique perspective on international deal flow. From your desk or from the conversations you have in the Phoenix office of Squire Patton Boggs, you see a lot of things. And obviously some of those you're not going to be able to speak about. But at some level of generality, what can you tell us about what's going on in Phoenix as far as its international connections, the growth of international business? What does it look like from where you sit?
Sure. So what we've seen, at least in the last 3 years, we've had local, national, international deals come through valuing more than $4 billion. And even in just the last year, you know, so we have a client who was recently admitted to the Arizona FinTech Sandbox Verdigris. It's run by a group of amazing Australian/Irish guys who previously were in anti-money laundering and banking. And they did a national search for where they wanted to start their bank. And they chose Phoenix because not only because of the business environment, sort of our business friendly policies, but because they got to talk to people like the Global Chamber, the Greater Phoenix Economic Council, and we were so open to business that they wanted to form the bank here. Now, they didn't know when they came that it would be as friendly as it is. And since they've gotten here, we've really blown their socks off, partly because of the FinTech Sandbox. So that's a program administered by the Arizona Attorney General. And what it does is it allows companies to come in and test their product or service on a small market of Arizona residents before they have to get a license or go through sort of the regulatory loopholes and spend money and sort of extend their time to launch their product. When it was started, I think a year or two ago, it was unique to Phoenix, unique to Arizona, and there was no program like it in the U.S. I think a couple of jurisdictions are now trying to roll out something similar because they want to attract business. But what we've seen is companies like Verdigris are coming in and looking at not just Phoenix, but other markets as well in Arizona, and they want to grow their business because we're so business friendly. They're also able to find people, consultants who do international work, and they're able to find groups like the Global Chamber that connect them with that larger group because at least Verdigris, they want to go national, not just Arizona based, but they're able to find that global network to help them build their business and do it in a way that, you know, previously they thought they'd have to go to the East Coast. So maybe New York, maybe DC, maybe even San Francisco, because it's more fintech based. It's a non brick and mortar digital bank. And they want to serve the unbanked and underbanked, which means they want to cut the fees and make it easier for people who traditionally have a hard time accessing larger banks because they think they pose, either they don't have credit history or they don't have sort of a financial background. What we've seen here, they're looking outside of Phoenix and going to, I call it the Fertile Crescent of Arizona, Yuma, Arizona. We've had a couple of clients come in and build large agricultural, farming, manufacturing, military type projects because it is an untapped resource and it has been so good for their business. And we have the right people to introduce them and to bring them into the Global Chamber there, to the Economic Development Group there. And so I think once people get here and they meet, you know, the awesome group that we have, we've got the lifestyle, we've got the right economic factors. I mean, you know, we talk about fintech refugees coming from, you know, San Francisco, from Silicon Valley, from San Fernando Valley, everywhere, because this is a more business-friendly environment. It's easier to grow your business and it's easier to have a lifestyle. I think people are learning, like you said, Tina, like you can do business anywhere and you don't have to live, you know, in New York or DC or wherever to do the same type of global meaningful work. And so we're just seeing a lot of inquiries coming from all over the world, and we're able to do it with our Arizona Nexus because we've got the right resources, we've got the right education pipeline, we've got the right talent resources. It's just making sure that we can, you know, market Arizona in a way that is meaningful and get people to come here. I think once they come here and they take a look around, you know, they put their nose under the tent, this is an incredibly attractive place to do business, but it's just sort of making sure our voice is heard over the other markets that might have a longer and more established, I guess, marketing machine.
You know, it's so fascinating to me. I want to educate myself more about this, but just from my naive point of view, it seems like there's two sectors, they're not really sectors, but two areas of business where the payment processing financial services side of things create some really thorny problems. One is the legal cannabis industry, and the other is any kind of international
payment system, payment transfer
system.
Yep.
Because unlike some places in Africa that figured out 15 years ago how to send money all over the place to remote villages with SMS messages on flip phones, what it takes to move money around in a timely way to meet the regulatory requirements, to comply with all the anti-terrorism, money laundering initiatives, all of which are vital and important, and we have to, you know, we have to do that. But the FinTech Sandbox as a very forward-thinking initiative that creates a huge opportunity for innovation, because you have to test this stuff out in the wild. You can't just wireframe these kind of things and say, like, look, here's my concept. Like, it has to work. And there's a level of complexity. So having an environment in which you can actually deploy and test new innovations. And then the second thing that I also want to learn more about is the so-called Fertile Crescent, the greater Yuma area, which includes, you know, both sides of the border. Well, all three, really, because it's California, Arizona, and Mexico. Another very interesting, I mean, we're talking about spaceports. We're talking about all kinds of stuff happening down there. And I think sometimes up here in Maricopa County, we tend to sleep on what's happening in some of the other areas of this state. Now, I'm curious to highlight something from your own bio, Ali. When you got a Fulbright grant and went to South Korea, it wasn't your first international period of time, but it must have been deeply formative in some ways. What did you learn? What shaped the way you think and act now?
Yeah. So when I was in college, I wanted to take some time between college and law school to sort of develop a little bit more and feel ready to sort of enter the professional world. And I chose Korea because it's considered the comeback kid of global economy. So in the 60s, it was an agriculture-based economy. And since then, it has grown, I think, into the 12th largest economy in the world, I think right after Russia in terms of GDP. And so their growth has been attributed primarily to them opening their borders and engaging the international community to fixing their business environment and also investing heavily in innovation. And so for me, as you know, an economics major, that was really interesting to me. And so when I went over, Fulbright has a couple different programs. And so I went over to be a cultural ambassador to teach students and to do my own independent research. And so my first year, they put me on a small tropical island off the southern coast called Jeju. And it's very isolated and they have you do intensive language training and you stay in a homestay. And so there's no better way to get out of your comfort zone than to be fed pickled fish and sleep on a floor for a year and really sort of learn how to adapt and sort of engage in that culture. When I left, my host mother said, you know, we really like Ali because she's almost Korean. Which is an incredible compliment. But I spent a year there and I really grew to love the culture, grew to love their education system. It is incredibly rigorous, but the things that they teach their young people about commitment and discipline, I think had a big impact on me, even though I was in my 20s. And then I moved the following year up to Seoul to be a special assistant to the executive director of Fulbright Korea and the Korean American Educational Commission and a liaison to the U.S. Embassy in Seoul. My primary function was to help with programming, to be a liaison there and to be her speechwriter. But spending that time before I came back, I think there are things that you learn. I mean, you know, Tina, you know, you're from another country. You came back. I feel like when you're abroad, you learn so much about building skills that are really hard to get when you're younger, right? Independence, adaptability, diplomacy, things that like I would not have been exposed to, I think, if I had not left and come back. And 2 years was enough time for me to not only learn all those things, but also really appreciate where I came from and want to come back and sort of engage in an international legal career and go from there. And so that's what led me to Korea. That's what led me to come back and has really sort of informed my practice since then, because I've always wanted to have a global practice. And it's interesting that you mentioned your interest in payment systems. When I first started practicing in DC, I did global banking and payment systems. And so some of our clients were large cryptocurrency exchanges. We worked with the Winklevoss twins on new platforms and payment systems that were at the time not heavily regulated. And I think the comfort you get from putting yourself out there, working abroad, living abroad, working in legal systems that are not as well defined, there's a sense of comfort and like a can-do attitude that you get because you feel like you can figure it out no matter what, you know, what situation you're in. And so, you know, coming back, like I tell all the young people now, like you need to get out of Arizona and you'll come back. I'm confident that you will, but you need to get out of here and explore and really push yourself, make yourself uncomfortable, learn how to do business in a different culture and a different environment, because it'll make you a better professional and a better person.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. In fact, I used to tell students when I taught at Berkeley that the best thing you could do is go away for a long time and not even be part of a formal study abroad program, although this will freak your parents out, because the best things you're going to learn, kind of the hard way. And it's fascinating. You don't often associate corporate law with a kind of entrepreneurial mindset, in many cases playing defense rather than offense. But I really love what you're speaking to, Ali, about how kind of thinking outside the box and problem solving and just simply seeing other ways of doing things, of not just of eating, but also of working, of meeting, of talking, of moving, of sleeping, of praying, of just, you know, you start to realize, oh, this is, my way is not the only way. Tina, this takes us directly into, I think, some issues around education.
Because
one of the things that, you know, is so important for the future is to have young people who come up with a skill set, a flexibility, a creativity, a way of teaching themselves. And I know you've been involved in a number of different ventures. Why don't you speak to some of those and why you think education is such a critical frontier for global life and business?
Well, to start with that, I wanted to comment on two of the things of your personal experiences that we heavily try to educate and expose a lot of the young people in Jordan about, which is appreciative inquiry. And appreciation is actually, you know, it's like your golden key to change. As soon as you start appreciating the certain things that you don't have on the table, then you can like spark someone's aha moment, and then they're like, oh, I want to change into that. But at the pace that we're moving, and because I moved here because of my son, I started looking, you know, I worked also in accreditation for international schools. So I started looking at the educational system in Arizona and seeing like, you know, yeah, I can encourage a lot of young people to go and get exposed to other cultures and everything else. But then, you know, there's so much good in Arizona. I mean, I can start with the weather all year long. I mean, minus the summertime, but
not weather. That needs a special category.
I'll figure out a word
of intensity. The only place I've ever lived that was hotter than this was Baghdad, and
yeah, well,
you know.
But then you also have like a good infrastructure for ACs and things like that, and you've noticed like in other countries. And then
well,
there
was no infrastructure there because we had blown it up right before I arrived. I was working as a civilian journalist and aid worker, but the power was out for the entire summer of 2003. It was like 56 degrees Celsius, which for those of you who speak Fahrenheit is really hot.
But then you start appreciating, you know, you have, and I mean, there's obviously less traffic than other cities in Phoenix. There's a good AC system. There's summer, but you don't feel it like there's a real bad summer. One of the things that got me thinking as a mom for a six-year-old is, do I want my son to really go through school and graduate and then he will get opportunities to figure it out? Or can I start right now? And this is one of the conversations Adrian and I had maybe a year ago, because you homeschool your kids. And we were talking about one of the things that you appreciate in a lot of the cultures is the upbringing part in schooling. And it's really, as we spoke, can you teach kids conflict resolution, empathy, team building, problem solving skills, and everything at a very young age? And I'll be very honest with you, looking for a school for my son, I probably toured with accreditation glasses on 136 schools. And I was like, oh my God, why is education number 50? And at the same time, you know, I have very close relationships with ASU, and we're talking about, you know, like state of the art education after you graduate school. So where can we bridge that gap? I'm a founding board member of a school right now, because I've learned all my life and all of the experience I've been through is, you know, you need to be the change and walk the talk. So we started a school with a group of innovative educators who also saw the same feel. There needs to be a change, and there needs to be a change from the traditional school to a learning community. A community of learners, which is what we're trying to do among everyone here. When you do business, would you do everything else? So there is Phoenix Modern, where actually it's a crucial part of every day in their curriculum. We use Sanford Harmony's educational curriculum, where the focus on empathy, team building, problem solving, inquiry, appreciation is integrated into the core skills. And the kids, their homework after school is how to apply these learned concepts rather than sit down in what I call cheat sheets for testing. And I learned that there is a way, and Arizona actually is a very good place to start and be the change, because there are so many incentives. I mean, so many incentives in education, in taxes, and even building a company. I mean, you can have your own company set up or your non-for-profit set up in less than 2 hours right now. But the thing is, it's how do you connect the dots between everyone. So everyone sees a big picture and not everyone is reinventing the wheel. And that is where I feel there is a need for young people to connect and to exchange ideas and exchange experiences through forming the Young Global Leaders as part of the Global Chamber. Because through events like what I've been involved in for 11 years, which is New Think Theater, we created a platform that is theater-like where anyone who has an experience or a story or have succeeded or failed can stand on a podium and say that. And the purpose is to inspire, entertain, educate, and network people. At the same time, we have 10,000 people attending 3 times a year. And I was like, well, why can't we do that here? Because there is a hunger and there is a need for it. So these are some of the things on the agenda for the Young Global Leaders is to have at least 3 events a year where members can interact. And the added benefit is we also have, I don't like to call them the senior members, but we also have the more experienced CEOs, the entrepreneurs who actually went through the really hard part of a startup, you know, where there wasn't, the world was not as connected. Laws and regulations are things that are, you know, being formed. There was so much uncertainty and they made it through and now they're running these companies and they can give back to younger people through mentorship, through advice, or even to me, one of the most successful things that we saw in the Young Global Leaders first event was the small focus groups that formed after we had a lineup of speakers. Because it's not what you say is how you influence after that.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned our own choice to opt out of school, and it's really not for any religious or ideological reason. Although I know there are people who homeschool for those reasons. We're a secular family. We're global. We're anti-authoritarian and can't be bothered to be on somebody else's schedule as parents. So, you know, of course, it's going to be like that was a part of it. But more than that, I fundamentally believe that education is essential and school is broken. Yeah. And the way that we've done school in this country, by the way, not for very long. Mm-hmm. If you actually look at the history of compulsory education, and yes. I'm getting on my soapbox, so I'm aware I got to be careful here. It's not about my opinion on these things. But I think it's worth thinking about. We want entrepreneurial, innovative, creative kids, and yet we put most of them through a school that suppresses all those things because of the unfortunate realities that classrooms are dominated by behavioral management and testing standards and things of that nature, that every teacher who gets in with a passion for teaching at some point grapples with this existential crisis of, you know, what happened to my love of learning given I'm in an environment where we're doing so many other different kinds of things. So without trying to fix it, I admire you for making efforts in that
regard. Well, one of the things,
We said, listen, it's kind of like eating food. If you can grow your own through privilege and inclination and whatever else, if you can grow your own organic food, eat that. It's going to be better for you. Should everybody do that? No, of course not. So finding equitable solutions for everyone is important. Go ahead.
That's true. And then also, as we talk about global entrepreneurship, one of the things that struck me after my very gifted child came back home from school and said and told me, am I allowed? And then I paused and I'm like, what? Am I allowed to try this or am I like, and I'm like, well, that's not my home upbringing, but let me actually look at the core cause of why is it this way. And I realized that one of the things that I think Arizona and maybe a lot of the companies that are investing in Arizona should take a look at as social impact investment or corporate social responsibility is how do you invest in education, but primarily teachers. One of the lessons I learned in the Middle East is once you train and equip teachers as change agents in the classroom, they not only change the students, they change the classroom, they change the school, and they change the community. And then you achieve countries like Jordan, who has become a developed country from a developing country in less than 10 years. And how can we achieve that in Jordan? I looked at some of the teachers in public schools, and they really haven't left their own hometown. They don't have passports. They don't have that global perspective. So I'm in the process of working on an initiative where we do a connection a virtual training connection, and it's an exchange program, but with the less cost of travel and leaving. I know the experience is different, but is how can you have teachers in Arizona do an exchange with teachers in Finland, in Sweden, doing a 360 virtual classroom tour using virtual reality and using technology at hand today, while broadening their horizons, if I may say, to what education is in other countries. Because that's the only way we can sit down and say, well, we're number 50, 49, you know, it's going back and forth. But I think there is that responsibility for also for entrepreneurs, for companies in Arizona that are coming in to really think. Because at the end of the day, when you have a company in Arizona, when you do business in Arizona, your family, your kids, and everyone is going to be here. How can you actually be the change?
Yeah. And I will also say, to balance out my kind of strong words a few minutes ago, that I'm inspired by leaders within the school systems who are looking for ways to elevate and extend the human dimension of this. We had in here Dr. Tracy Lopeman, who's the superintendent of the Maricopa school district, and also Brian Garcia, who's on the board for Tempe Union School District, High School District. And they spoke very passionately about things like equity and inclusion and awareness of diversity and things of that nature. Annabelle Abaya, that's something that's at the heart of African Fest USA. Awareness, interaction, you know, encounter. Talk to us a little bit about the event. You've had them already, and the next one's going to be in March 2020. How did this come to be, and what's the impact you're trying to make with African Fest USA?
And I will go back to your first comment, you know, earlier. You said when everybody think about Africa, what you think is that small kid with a fly on his face, war, starvation, disease, problem. So I've seen that working with big NGOs, you know, they do some good job, but most of the time, you know, aid, not the problem, the solving solution for the Africa. So my goal was when I started this, when I started to reform the nonprofit organization, African Fest USA. So somebody has to tell his own story. I don't want someone else to tell my story. For example, if Tina tell about my story, she doesn't know that much. I can't tell her story. So we need to, as an Africans, we need to tell our own stories, and all the negative image what we have to rebrand Africa's image now, because that's the only way Africa will be benefit for the future, because Africa is the richest continent in the world in mining and everything, except I don't know why we are poor. I don't know.
Well, there's a history of imperialism and colonialism.
Yes, but that's how you change, because still we are talking about, like, you know, UNICEF, for example, I see on TV, they're still begging money for that kid recurred 30 years ago. So you have to give a dollar a month and then something like that. So I said, let's change the narrative in our way. The young and professionals who especially live in North America, they have opportunity to change Africa's image now. So how we can do that? First has to be the platform, be a cultural exchange. So that cultural exchange to bring people together in the same area. So that way we show and tell our stories. For that, for example, I proved this concept in 2017. I did an Ethiopian festival before I did in Mesa Convention Center. It was sold out show. And what we did is we show what's good about Ethiopia, not bad. The bad, I just leave it for mainstream media and then NGOs. But for the good things, what Ethiopia offer for the world, good. So it's a 10-minute documentary video. We show that. Because of that video, we encourage, like, we, I think, become an inspired 6 families from Arizona to travel to Ethiopia to visit Ethiopia. That means for me, you know, we put a little dot there that we show some good positive thing, and then people go there, the tourism industry is working. Some people get a little bit of money, right? That's a starting point. So now we show our culture together, collectively, 55 countries together. We show like 3,000 tribes in Africa. Think about it. It's a lot to tell. And when 1.2 billion people demanding if you can supply, that the global chambers, again, if we can come together, everybody, so we can create a job for Africans, instead of giving them aid, education, the way I totally agree what she said today. It's all my vision for that is what you said. So I'm so happy actually to be with you today here. So that's the main cause of African Face to USA. Just we can be a starter for the future. The young leaders can take over and then, you know, tell African stories through music, culture, food, entertainment. But that's just a starting point. For next year, we're going to start, we have a plan to start the African Face to USA Film Festival. The 2021, we're trying to put sport. So everybody coming together was a good, because in the world, what I see is religion, politics, and race are the one who create problem. So we avoid those, bring in educational thing, slowly bring everybody together with music and culture activities, then Africa can be, you know, a future for the whole African, you know, if they tell. That's a main cause of African Face to USA. So next year we're trying to bring more than, you know, this year we had 24 countries participating in African Face to USA, different kind of activities. Then the next year we're expecting more. From the 55, I know it's Arizona's too tough to get, and we have, they said, we have more than 100,000 Africans live here in Arizona and the Valley. So if we can bring everybody together, not to show our culture for the world, but we can bring the young initiative to come in together, and then the global leaders can teach them how they can do much better thing to their continent. So that's an idea just to start for the future, and we'll see.
Annabelle, I really love so much of what you just said. I wrote my PhD dissertation years ago on what I called the humanitarian industrial complex, and specifically the way in which aid agencies and the media work together to create the narrative of suffering, and the way that disempowers people. And of course, myself as a privileged white WASPy, you know, North American storyteller, my job was to go around and tell the story of these places. It's partly the discomfort that emerged for me and kind of the conflict around that, like, what are we doing here, that led to this. And I like the fact that you connected that opening thought with your goals and commitments for African Fest USA, because the pitfall of a festival is it becomes exotic. It becomes, you know, look at the colorful costumes and the strange foods and the drumming and the whatever. Oh yes, that was great, like African experience. And it does in a same way, just the inverse of the flies in the eyes pictures, which is it creates this generic kind of stereotype. So I loved that you talked about the fact that really this is for you and for your community, and finding ways to bring people together to connect with each other and then start to tell their own stories. I couldn't be a bigger buyer of that theme. And if there's obviously any way we can help, obviously sometimes it's just by getting out of the way, passing the microphone, which is literally what we're trying to do here. As we wrap up this conversation, I could talk to all of you for hours. I'm just so passionate about what you're doing. What I'd love to hear from each of you, kind of go around, what are some of the opportunities or ideas that you think more people who might be inspired by some of what we're talking about need to look into, need to explore? Either there are resources or people they need to meet, companies or organizations, anything of that nature. If you could create a little mini curriculum, either for the young or the old, what would go in there? What is it you want people to know to begin broadening their horizons to some of the issues we've been talking about? Tina?
I think I always like to look at solutions. I mean, we can talk about problems for a whole day, but I always like to look at solutions. One of the things that I started working when I consult in social impact investment, people look at me and they're like, what does that mean? And I said, well, if I look by location and by data. So what I like to do is look at clients who can really help each other based on a very immediate need within a 5-mile radius. And really, I chop my work plan into 5-mile radiuses of clients that can help each other. Really, a lot of the times, your next community partner is in your backyard. And I build the impact that way. And a lot of the times it's companies that want to do purposeful marketing that can partner with schools. I mean, each entrepreneur, each company, each startup, you look around as you're driving by and it tells you, slow down, you're actually passing through a school. And you look and then they have a needs assessment. Every year, they have a lot of needs. If we can really jump over that gap of schools relying on aid, whether they're charter or private or whatever, and try to see how you can be of an added value to an education curriculum, for one, or how you can take the hands of a teacher or the students and bring them into your company and learn what you're doing. I'm bringing you some of the kids into your studio, by the way. These are some of the initiatives. I wanted to speak just for like less than 30 seconds about one of the things that I learned that got me to do another entrepreneurial initiative. I'll call it a startup right now. Is I moved from Jordan. I had my son, and my son has a 1 in 10 million rare disease. And he's overcome it because of really good healthcare in the US. But what it taught me is, how can I take that experience and turn it into something that would benefit everybody else? So to make it short, I developed a virtual reality game that teaches children how to control their neurogastrointestinal system. And we have a proverb in Jordan that says, the shortest way to a man or woman's heart is through his stomach. And I started looking at it like, okay, well, it's food. How can I take that and turn it into an experience? So it has that global added perspective of, you can be from any country in the world and learn how that country can help you empower your microbiome. It's that, it's always that training our mindsets to appreciate the experiences we have and look deeper into connecting the dots of where our path is taking us, wherever we are. And since we're all in Arizona, I think... never underestimate the power of four people around one table in a radio station.
Exactly. That's the reason we exist, for sure. Annabella Baya, excuse me, Abaina. I've probably been saying that wrong the whole time.
You did it right.
Okay. Yeah. Annabelle, what are some of the opportunities you want more people to know about, be aware of? Where would you point them?
Here, actually, for example, in local businesses, you know, there are so many local, you know, nobody knows them, small businesses, you know, to shop around together, you know, helping small business, because they are the main core of the economy here in Arizona. You know, I've seen that's one of the platform we make in African Face to USA. So small businesses, but they need to be, you know, people need to know them more. They can go and then support them. The big companies, they have the the power to introduce themselves, but these are the ones who don't have any chance. So, you know, let's help them. That's what I always suggest, to go, you know, to see, you know, local businesses, always small business especially, they need visibility, an opportunity for them, you know, financial support from the bank system or something, because it's so hard to get financial system from the bank for the small businesses. So if we can create some kind of, you know, opportunity for those that are big leaders, they can be a global partnership for the future too. That's start small and you can grow. That's what I'm thinking. That's my...
Marvelous. Thank you very much. Ali Anderson, from the small business to the big corporate, from the elementary school education to university, no pressure.
Yeah.
Speaking to all of that, what would you say are the opportunities or ideas you wish more people were aware of?
So I think, you know, a great place to start, I know we've mentioned the Global Chamber a few times. Doug runs an awesome organization, and I think anyone, regardless of their vintage or their industry, if they're looking to get more involved and just meet people so they can find opportunities. Annabelle has his own network. Tina has her own network. You have your own. And so there's something out there for everybody. And so one of the best ways to start, they have an event on December 10th. It's called the Phoenix Global to Local Innovation Summit. They have, you know, a ton of wonderful speakers coming. It's from 12:30 p.m. to 6:30 p.m. And so it's a full day of just networking and learning and being inspired. And I think just getting yourself in the room and talking with people and finding the opportunities that speak to you and your mission is really important. There are a number of leadership and training programs in the Valley that, you know, not a lot of people know about or take advantage of. When I first moved back, I was looking to dig in more, and I started to do a Valley Leadership Advance, which is for people who are new to the Valley or new to civic engagement. And they bring these leaders together and talk about local issues and how you can make an impact, and then sort of work forward from there on smaller projects to sort of move our community forward. There are dozens of programs like that. And so I think just, you know, networking and talking to people, the difference that I've noticed between the East Coast and Phoenix, we have a very open infrastructure. There are a lot of barriers to entry on the East Coast and sometimes on the West Coast, where it's institutionalized and it's hard to sort of dig in and meet the people you need to meet. Here, city of transplants, people who are, I think, very entrepreneurial in their mindset. And so it is really easy to get in the room, meet the people you want to meet, and everyone is very helpful and open. And so I think just putting yourself, you know, in that situation and being open and meeting people, I think you'd be surprised by the opportunities that follow.
The best advice I had, aside from leave the country and stay away for a while, was to university students, and applies to entrepreneurs and small business owners as well, which is you are surrounded by people that could open your eyes to things if only you'd have conversations with them. Go knock on doors. Go introduce yourself to the shop owners, the restaurants, to the companies. You could literally walk in almost anywhere. And if your intent is good, you listen, people are busy and you might not always get the meeting the very first time. But I think Annabelle's story of going to Whole Foods without any idea for how to get distribution, it's something that many small business owners might sit around and stew about for a long time and not take action on. But going and having that conversation opened up a whole new vista for your business, for your family, and is just an example of have the conversation, make the connection, and see where it leads you. And I would agree, Ali, that the best place to do this here in the near future is this Global to Local Innovation Summit. And I want to say one additional word about this. The Global Chamber is wonderful as I'm getting more and more involved. I'm meeting more and more wonderful people. But sometimes I think we have to acknowledge that the idea of global can be a bit intimidating. Seems that there's a big scary world out there. It's complex. If you're young, you may have some fear around it. If you're old, you may have some fear around it for different reasons. The idea of this summit is to really bring together some of the best and the brightest, the warmest, the most committed. You'll walk in a stranger and you'll leave with dozens of new friends. And the idea here is not only for global companies to find local connections. It's for local businesses and students and entrepreneurs to begin to think about what would it look like if I were to grow, whether it was grow my business, grow my outlook, right, grow my professional career. And so, SkySong, December 10, 12:30 to 6:30. You can get tickets at the Global Chamber's website, globalchamber.org. I'm going to be there. I'm really looking forward to meeting everybody who comes there as well.
And I also wanted to say, if you couldn't make it, I mean, one of the things we created as an advisory board for the Global Chamber is the Young Global Leaders membership as well, which is under $25. And you can have access to a lot of the whole year long in-person and virtual events that we have as part of Global Chamber. And to end on note, Global Chamber actually has chapters in multiple parts of the world, and we have chapters in almost every state right now. And it's really the local Global Chamber chapter actually does a lot of networking and education and appreciation for its members and for its guest members as well, locally. And it's giving that opportunity, local and global. So the Global Chamber is a whole perspective, but there is a lot of local and there is a lot of appreciation for everyone who has the intention of doing not only business, but being part of that change.
Exactly. So whether you're already involved in international affairs of some form or another, or whether you're just global curious, go to globalchamber.org and you'll get all the information on membership and the summit. I want to thank each of you for joining us here for this conversation. Ali Anderson, Annabelle Abena, and Tina Swais. Thank you so much for joining us here today.
And thank you for hosting us.
Thank you for having us.
My pleasure. Yeah. For all of us here at Business Radio X, this is Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and we'll see you next time on Valley Business Radio.